Founded in 1991 by patients, the FSHD Society is the largest grassroots network of FSHD patients, their families, and research activists. The FSHD Society offers a community of support, news, and information for the millions of people affected by FSHD worldwide. This is FSHD Society Radio.
All right, great. Well, I want to thank everybody for being here today for this special episode of the FSHD Radio. You might be saying to yourself, who is that woman on the mic? That doesn't sound like Tim. And that is very true. Our regular host, Tim Hollenbach, is not with us. He is dealing with a family emergency, actually loss in the family. So if anyone out there that knows and listens to Tim and loves this show, send all your positive vibes, warm wishes to his family this week. And we certainly miss him. So don't worry, he will be back for our next episode. But I am Lee Reynolds. I am the Chief Program Strategy Officer with the FSHD Society. And I'm thrilled to be filling in for Tim today. And I have with me Amy Halseth, who is the FSHD Program Manager with Avidity. And so thanks, Amy. I appreciate you being here on the show with us today.
Yeah, thanks for asking me. I'm happy to be here and try and answer some more questions.
Fantastic. So for those of you that don't know or missed it, we did a great full hour plus episode with Amy, and I think you had some other folks on with you talking about the Fortitude trial on FSHDU, and we'll be sure and drop a link to that full hour recording. But there have been some updates since then, and we were flooded with tons of questions that we just couldn't get to in that amount of time. So I'm just thank you so much for agreeing to come back and maybe fill in some of the blanks and answer some more of those questions that that our community had. But before we get into that, Amy, just tell us a little bit about your work with Avidity Biosciences and how you got into the work of FSHD.
Yeah, so I've been with Avidity now for just over a year. I just passed my 1 year anniversary, so that was exciting. And I've been doing clinical development work for a long time, but across lots of different diseases, different therapeutic areas, diabetes, osteoporosis, obesity, osteoarthritis. So lots of different kinds of diseases. And this was my first time actually really learning about FSHD or learning about the rare disease community. And so I was able to take kind of the skill of knowing how to run clinical trials and do that. But what I've learned over the last year is really about FSHD, the disease, and also just the community and what a unique space this is within the rare disease community. And it's been a real honor for me to be able to work in this space for the last year.
Well, I agree with that. I had not heard anything about FSHD before I came to work with the organization back in 2018, even though I'd been in the single disease space most of my career. I, like you, just think it's a really amazing community. And yeah. I love all the families that I've gotten to know. And they are very, very interested in what is happening with the Fortitude trial. So as I mentioned at the start, last month, you all participated in our full webinar for FSHDU about the Fortitude trial. But I think there've been a couple of changes, a couple of updates since then. So bring us up to speed since we last spoke. What's happening now with Fortitude since we last spoke?
Yeah, I wish there were like more extremely exciting updates. I mean, really, it's just kind of rolling along with getting all of these sites up and running and ready to start enrolling patients. We have about 15 or so sites across the United States and Canada, you know, that we're working on right now. So we really are just getting them all up and running. We have our two sites that are sort of leading the pack, I would say, are very, very close to being able to enroll patients. And we'll be able to put more information up on the clinicaltrials.gov website as they actually truly go live instead of being like almost live, which is where I'd say they are right now. And also as, you know, more sites become active, we'll be able to share more information through the FSHD Society channels as well to keep that information out there. So it's happening. We're doing our best. A lot of people are working really hard on it. It's just a lot to get these sites up and running. You know, there's a lot that goes on with clinical trials, and we do them with universities. So usually it's academic researchers at universities. So if anybody's ever dealt with university administration and all of the different groups and channels and committees and things that oversee things, you can imagine it's not a simple path to get a study really up and running.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of rigor that goes into it, a lot of checks and balances, and it certainly takes some time. But
yeah, and of course, we want all the safety stuff and all of the important stuff. I don't mean to say we shouldn't be doing that. Yeah, that's all very important.
Yeah, I think it's good for our audience, for our families to understand. We often get a lot of questions about inclusion, exclusion criteria, and why do some things take so long? And I think it's always a good reminder that all of this rigor around a trial is important because it helps it be successful.
Yeah. And this is the first time, you know, our compound will go into humans, people. Mm-hmm. And so making sure that we have all of the safety oversight in place, making sure that the ethics committees and institutional review boards have reviewed everything. And that you just, like you said, some of these checks and balances are really important because what we want to do is just make sure that we have all of the infrastructure in place, mm-hmm. both from the safety standpoint, but also the ability to just execute the trial. So while it takes a while, and that can be frustrating for all of us who want it to go faster, a lot of these are really important steps along the way.
Absolutely. So it is now listed on clinicaltrials.gov. Yes. And so if folks want to continue to get updates, that's a great place to go as new things, as sites become open.
And there's an email address that you can reach out to now. That just comes to Avidity and you basically get on some, I'm actually not positive to whom it goes at Avidity. I think my name is listed, but I don't get those emails. But yeah, the best thing to do is just kind of check back periodically. I think the FSHD Society will probably be our best partner in getting the word out like that. Now there are multiple.
Yeah, we sites. Actually have information. If anybody, sometimes people get a little flummoxed trying to find their way around clinicaltrials.gov. It's a little, It can be clunky, you know. We will absolutely, we have a link on our site on our clinical trials page that'll send you straight to that. And we try to keep that updated with information as we find it out as well. Yeah. So hopefully we can be a conduit. And then of course, whenever you have information for us to let our folks know, we'll, be sending out emails and notifications and information as we have it to anyone that's on our list. Remind our listeners how many people you're looking for in this first phase of the trial.
So it's about 72 patients total that we're looking for. And this is a first in human study. A lot of times those are conducted in healthy volunteers, but we're actually going into people who have FSHD from the very beginning. And people will receive treatment for up to, well, it's 9 months of treatment and then another 3 months of follow-up. So the duration that a person would be in a trial is for a whole year. So we're able to look both at kind of the safety of the drug, especially very early where we're very cautious. We go with very low doses, lots of safety oversight. And then assuming that looks good, we're able to continue to follow people to try and get some sense of the efficacy of the drug as well over a year.
Excellent. Well, we covered a lot of these questions were answered in that full length FSHDU.
There were a lot of questions.
There were a lot. We covered a lot of the details there, and that recording is readily available on our YouTube channel and through our website. We'll make sure that it's linked into this show as well. But we had three sort of buckets of questions that your team went back through that we weren't able to get to the last time, that we thought we might try and cover some of those today. And so we have some science-related questions, some operational questions, and some community-related questions. So why don't we just dig in to some of those science-related questions. These are questions that came in from that FSHDU session that we didn't have a chance to get to. And so first, lots of questions around, can you predict how your drug will work? Will it impact muscle loss and regrowth? Will the treatment affect other body systems, including heart muscle? Will the drug work in all types of FSHD and ranges of severity? So that's a lot of loaded questions, but I'll just let you speak.
Yeah.
And how you are hoping or predicting or what are you looking for it to do?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I think we just have to all remember this is the first in human trial. So there's no data right now that really tells us. So it's all predictions based on kind of the way we think we understand or, what we believe to be the mechanism of the disease. There's data from animal models or transgenic animals that we can kind of ask some of these questions and maybe get a hint. But the real answer is we don't really know. Mm-hmm. We believe that by targeting DUX4, which our drug does, it directly targets DUX4 and prevent the protein from being made and prevent those downstream effects, that it should, it really would have a strong belief that it should stop the progression of FSHD worsening. But the real question that I don't think there's a way to answer until we do these experiments is, well, in the setting where you're stopping DUX4 and the muscle isn't getting worse, and you're not having that continued insult from more DUX4 surges, does the muscle actually recover and do you regain some strength and function? I mean, we really hope so. And you can come up with a mechanism by which that would make sense. But again, we just have to do the experiments to really understand that. In terms of like other places in the body, for example, the heart, it's interesting because I think the heart is an area that may have some involvement in FSHD, but it's subtle and in a subset of people. We know that our drug does get taken up into heart tissue, and if there is DUX4 expressed in the heart, it should presumably knock it down. It's very similar to the way it would work in skeletal muscle. But that's something, you know, we can't test directly. Like we're not taking heart biopsies or doing...
Yeah.
That's not.
I don't think that's a thing, really.
not here. We'll be doing this. We'll be for sure looking for any safety signals around the heart, like changes in blood pressure, vital signs, ECG. So we'll be kind of looking at the heart that way. But I think it's a really interesting question going forward, especially maybe for people who do have some mild heart issues that might be related to their FSHD. If those change, if they receive our drug, I think that's something that'll take longer and bigger studies to understand. But it's a really interesting question. And then in terms of severity, I mean, since our drug will mostly work in skeletal muscle, the way we're thinking about it for severity is if there are muscles that have just a lot of damage, a lot of fat replacement, and they're not really very muscly anymore. Mm-hmm. It seems less likely that our drug would work there than a muscle that's maybe in the earlier stages and still has a lot of relatively healthy muscle tissue and a lot of, you know, is still has kind of the machinery to make more muscle.
Okay.
But again, it's something we'll just have to test going forward long term. And, you know, we know that within a person, you can have a whole range of muscles of different severity. Mm-hmm. Like a person's triceps might be really, really impaired, but their bicep might still seem okay. So we'll actually be able to get, I think, some answers about more severely impacted muscle and if our drug is able to have any impact on those muscle. So people who have right now a very severe progression overall, we wouldn't be able to study just because a lot of the functional measures they may not be able to do. But I think we'll get some answers about how the drug could work in muscles of different severity, just because people do have, like I said, individual muscles that have a lot of differences.
So does that relate to the need for the muscle biopsies and where the muscle biopsies would be taken from?
Yeah, so we do have two muscle biopsies planned in the study, and that would be before you start getting the drug and then after you've gotten a couple of doses of the drug. And what we're really looking for there is both, first, how much of the drug is actually getting into muscle. So we're able to, you know, grind up the muscle and actually measure the drug concentration from that sample. And then another is how much DUX4 gene activity is going on in that muscle. So what we're hoping to see is a relatively high level of DUX4 gene expression in the people who receive placebo, and that we've really brought that down by maybe 50, 75, 80%, something like that, in the people who receive our treatment, because that is directly targeting that DUX4 mRNA.
Okay. That's exciting to think about.
Yeah. get rid of the bad guy, basically.
Yeah, let's get rid of the bad guy for sure. So I know that we have had some different conversations offline, not here, talking a little bit about the need for excluding certain groups or really restricting the cohort to some pretty specific standards. Can you talk a little bit to that, the reasoning behind that? Specifically, we've had some questions about mobility restrictions, if those that are under 18 or were diagnosed before the age of 18. Can you speak to the need for those restrictions and how do you anticipate those, continuing to be in play in the future?
So I think a lot of our listeners have a lot of appreciation already that FSHD is really variable. Like if, you know, you think of the people that you know who all have the same disease, right? It can have very different rates of progression, very different ways that FSHD manifests. Some people might have just very subtle symptoms. Some people are going very quickly and how their disease is changing over time. And if you think about doing an experiment where you want two groups of people who are relatively similar at the start, and if you didn't do anything, their progression would be about the same, you have to try and get to kind of the same types of people who come into the trial. Because if, you know, especially in a pretty small trial like this one is, if let's say you just got unlucky with how you randomized and the people who went really fast, had a very fast progression, were all in your placebo group, and all the people who were just, you know, kind of in a stable, steady state, all got your drug, you might think the drug worked great, but it could just be that you got unlucky in how the people got divided between the groups. So most of the restrictions that we have in terms of like age or age of onset are really designed to try within reason to get a more homogeneous population of who goes into that first trial, because it's that variability in progression and what the disease looks like in which muscles are affected can just make it really, really hard in a pretty small study like this to understand how your drug is working. And then for mobility specifically, the study includes things like how long it takes you to climb four stairs or to go down four stairs or to walk a certain distance. And if you're not able to do that, you know, we can't collect those measures for you. Sure. So again, because it's a relatively small trial, we need data from every person who's in that trial. So we can't just take a bunch of people who can't complete some of the assessments.
That makes sense.
That's where we are now, right? Because it's our first study. And I think the idea would be as we go to the next stage of trials, which are usually a little bit bigger, usually have fewer assessments because we have a clearer idea of what are the key assessments we're going to be doing. We usually have a little more flexibility in who we would include in that trial. So because, you know, a couple people who have a faster or slower progression are going to have a lot less of an impact if the trial has, you know, let's say 75 people per group versus if there are four people per group.
Sure. Right? So if I were to summarize that in my language, that it makes sense, it would be you want it as similar, the folks that are in the trial in the very beginning to be as similar as possible so you can get as consistent of a read on effectiveness.
Right.
So keep it really tight in the beginning so that you can improve your chances of success so that down the road, it is more widely available to more people because you've had a better chance of success in the beginning. So
I
think what I feel and hear from some of our folks is everyone wants something now. Of course they do. We all wanted therapies and a cure.
Yeah.
We can't get it fast enough, right? But there's a reason for the tight restrictions in the short term so that we can have the greater benefit for more in the long term.
Yeah.
That was an okay very way well to... said. Okay.
Yes.
Great. Great.
I'm going to use that.
So those were some of our science related questions. Now let's move to operational. So I think you talked a little bit about this already. We know that sites are in process. You're started to the listing on clinicaltrial.gov. Do you have a sense of timeline? I know some of these things you can't always predict how long getting all the ducks in a row will take.
Yeah, within the next, let's say 3 months, I think we'll have a number of sites across the country that are enrolling patients. So it is getting to the imminent stage. And over time, you know, as sites get activated and are ready to go, they just sort of go into that pool of being able to accept patients. So it is a real, it's a real time thing. Like as a site gets activated and they're ready to go, they appear on clinical
trials. That site's ready to go. It's not where they all
it's
have
not
to be
like
ready.
We wait for everybody till Got September it. And boom. It's like, hey, you're ready? Let's start. So it really does change over time.
Okay. Well, and of course, people, if you're not signed up and you're not on the FSHD Society's email list, we strongly encourage people that are interested at all to sign up with us, because as soon as we know anything, we'll target information to our folks as well.
Yeah. And then in terms of like results and updates, as a company goal, we're planning on releasing kind of some interim results in the first half of next year. So that's when we'll start to have a sense of a little more around how the study is actually going from the data standpoint.
Great. So what can folks expect from that enrollment process? We often get questions about what's asked of folks and what can they expect as they seek to enroll in a trial?
Yeah, so usually what would happen is, you know, once you connect with a site that's relatively close to you geographically, maybe it's in your same city, or maybe it's an easy plane ride away, and there might be a way we could, you know, we are helping patients with travel. So if there is a site that's like, oh, that's just, there's a direct flight, or it's a 2-hour drive, you know, don't let that stop you. But usually what happens is there's sort of an initial phone conversation just to kind of get some of the basics out. And that's a very, I would say, superficial kind of screening process. You know, how old are you? Do you have a genetic diagnosis of FSHD? How long have you had it? And just a little bit of getting to know between the interested person and the person at the site. And does it even seem like it's going to work? Like, this is the number of visits we have. This is when they would be. These are the expectations. So kind of like a just first date. It's like a, you know, chatting.
Sure.
From there, if it's like, boy, like on the surface, you seem to meet all the criteria. I can make it to the visits. This seems like a reasonable thing for me to participate in. Usually what would happen is that you would then travel to the site for a number of screening tests. And so it would be things like some blood work. We want to look at your labs, some functional tests to kind of assess your baseline function. There would be an MRI as part of this to see if you're eligible. And so basically, once all of the results of those eligibility tests are collected, then the site would let you know, yes, you're eligible, or no, you're not. Sorry. And from there, if you're eligible, then it's just kind of goes down the path of, okay, well, let's figure out the dates. When can we actually start? So your day one day would be the day that you would get your first dose of drug. And so it's really finding a date on the calendar to get sort of any assessments that need to be done before that first day. Then you come in for that first day of dosing, and then you just follow through with the visit schedule. So the safety follow-ups and the labs and all those sorts of things. But that beginning process, we want to make it so that we don't want somebody to like drive 2 hours to a research site and be like, oh, you're for this very obvious reason that we could have found out with a phone call. sorry for the drive. That was a bummer.
Let's try to get some of that initial screening done ahead of time.
And make it as streamlined as possible. And depending on how close people live, like if the site is in your city or if you're flying in, certain things like the MRI might be done on the same day or a different day, just depending on what works best for everybody's schedule. So the sites are going to do their best to be flexible, but there's a lot of different moving parts to coordinate. So even if you said, oh, I want to come in tomorrow for screening, it's like, well, wait, hold on. I have to get the MRI people. I have to get the physical therapist organized. I have to get this. So there's a lot of moving parts.
Sounds like. So for those that are really interested that are watching clinicaltrials.gov or waiting for the email to come from us, is there anything that they can do ahead of time or anything they need to know about that enrollment process that preps them for that?
Yeah, not really. I mean, it really is just kind of try and stay stable. I would say don't like join CrossFit or start some brand new thing. Don't start some new drug, because what we want is people who are in sort of a stable condition as they're coming in. But really just, you know, take care of yourself. And
so what about if they're in the Fulcrum trial, MOVE, or they're involved in some other studies?
Yeah, so, you know, we don't preclude people from, like, if you're in the natural history study, we wouldn't say you can't do that. But you're no longer really natural history if you're now taking an experimental drug. So you may have to choose if you're currently in the natural history study. If you're currently participating in, like, a Fulcrum trial, again, we have to have one at a time in this experimental
situation.
So we would not accept people who are currently in the Fulcrum study. If you were in a previous Fulcrum study or your time in the Fulcrum study did end, we do have a duration. If it's been more than a certain number of months, then you still could be eligible for ours. So like if you were in their phase 2 study but have stopped, or if you had to stop for some other reason, you still might be eligible for our studies.
Okay.
But again, the doctors would have at the site would have all the details, the specifics.
Perfect. So I think you mentioned this, but US, Canada, any other locations?
Yeah, we all are also planning for some sites in Europe. They have different processes that you need to go through with their regulatory agencies. And so we're working our way through those right now. So those will be starting a little bit later. But for now, it's US and Canada are the first batch.
So really the last thing I want to ask you today is just what role do you really think that the FSHD community plays in advancing therapies and getting us across the finish line? I mean,
we can't really do it without them, can we? Right. Exactly. I mean, we can't do it without the patients who are volunteering for these trials. And it's a big commitment and it's a big ask to get patients to come in and do this. It takes a lot of time. I mean, these are things, again, that haven't been in people before. We believe they're safe based on the work we've done in animal studies, but, you know, it's still new. So it's a huge ask to have people do this. And really, and not only just for our drug, but for all of the drugs and therapies that are coming down the path, you know, we need a lot of people kind of trying to enter sort of at the top of that funnel to see if there are enough who are going to be eligible for these different trials. And so, I mean, just continuing to pay attention. And if this trial is too weird or complicated, or there's not a site that's convenient for you, I would say keep listening, paying attention to FSHD Society, and, you know, keeping your ears open, because there might be another trial that's better for you. And so don't give up. If you try for one trial and don't get in, just kind of keep listening and keep looking for opportunities to volunteer. Because if you have the time and you are willing to do it, I mean, this is really what we need to make these all these therapies advance.
Absolutely. I think that's such an important point to end on, you know, is that we are so thankful and appreciative of all that our families do. The patients and families are really quite remarkable. And we are quite lucky and blessed to be able to work with and for them every day. We want to make progress. We want to put an end to this thing. We want to make people's lives better until we can cure it and all go home and focus on fixing something else in the world, right? I think we ran some numbers a few years ago with people a lot smarter than me. And we know that we need, you know, 8,000 to 10,000 active, well engaged, well vetted patients that are willing to put their hand up and be a part of the research to get to the patients that we believe we will need in the next couple of years to fill all of the trials that are happening. There is a lot happening, a lot of exciting things on the horizon. And so we're exceedingly thankful for all of the patients and families that are already engaged. And we are exceedingly thankful in advance for the next 5,000 that we believe that are going to come and put their hands up. We need to kind of double the roles to get to the numbers.
And all of the, you know, our feet on the ground are the research sites, and they do amazing work of interacting with the patients. They're the ones who would be, you know, handling those initial calls about, could I be eligible? Should we do that? And then doing all of that coordination at the sites. I mean, without the research sites and the patients, I mean, we're just sitting in an office, like making PowerPoints. Right. So just so much gratitude for everybody who's part of this, because it really, I mean, it's a little cliche, but it does take a village.
It does. It's a very much a team effort. And I, for one, I'm sure you share this sentiment. I will be very excited to get to that day when we can celebrate the first therapy gets across the finish line, and then the second, and then the third, until there's, you know, we have therapies for all and then cures for all. That's really what I think we're, this is a really robust and diverse and exciting community of people that all care very much about the patients and families. And so we're very thankful that you and your team are a part of it. And we will continue to push out information as all the sites go live. Let's get this thing filled quickly, you know, and on down the road, hopefully, you know, to the next phase and then to approval for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, Amy, anything else you want to tell our folks before we wrap things up?
No, just thank you, Lee. And thanks for all that you guys are doing too at the FSHD Society. You're a great partner. So we really appreciate it.
Thanks for being here and for taking the time to answer the rest of these questions and keep people informed. And we'll keep everybody updated on progress as it goes.
All right. Sounds good.
Thanks. Take care.
All right, thank you. Bye.